Welcome to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, the environment was a big story in Florida in 2019. The year has been one of the hottest on record. King tides were some of the highest recorded around the state. And even though Hurricane Dorian skirted along the Atlantic coast, it was another reminder of how vulnerable Florida is as climate change fuels more intense and wetter storms.
This also was the year the effects of climate change grabbed the attention of leading Republicans in the state legislature. Earlier this month, a Senate committee okayed a bill that will officially create an Office of Resiliency and a statewide sea level rise task force, two efforts championed by Governor Ron DeSantis. Julia Neshawat was appointed by the governor back in July as the state's first chief resilience officer. She spoke with WJCT's Adapt Florida project earlier this month.
There's a misconception that it's only just on the coastlines that we have these issues, and we tend to forget there's also other factors like precipitation, inland flooding that we have to also consider, aging infrastructure. The last four hurricanes were all Category 5. We're dealing with stronger storms, and so those preparations, sometimes, the mindset is just, well, if you're on the beach, that's the only folks that we're going to be focused on, and it's absolutely not the case.
So how will this entire state become more resilient, both at the beaches and inland? This hour, we're going to spend this hour on the Florida Roundup looking at the year 2019 as absolutely pivotal for this state in terms of responding to the threats posed by climate change. Joining us with their insights, we're pleased to welcome Dr. Jayantha Obisikera, Director and Research Professor in the Sea Level Solutions Center at Florida International University. Dr. Ben Kurtman, he's a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Miami. And Thomas Rupert, Coastal Planning Specialist with the Florida Sea Grant. Gentlemen, thanks to all three of you for appearing with us here on the Florida Roundup.
Happy to be here.
Good to have you all with us. Yes, good to have you all with us. Dr. Obi, let's start with you. As Tom and I noted, lately there's been a recent environmental tack here in Florida toward acknowledging climate science, which we hadn't seen in the past. At the same time, Florida has come under a lot of criticism for being very slow to deal with this reality despite the impact of climate change and our vulnerability as a coastal state. How do you assess the state's response now in 2019 that we're starting to see action in Tallahassee to deal with the impacts of climate change?
Hi, I'm really encouraged, particularly with this administration. Number one, I think we have a new resiliency officer at the state level, Dr. Julia Neshawat, and also we have a new statewide science officer, chief scientist. I think those are very good signs, and we've been talking a lot about response to sea level rise and other aspects of climate change. So I'm really encouraged with the response that we have seen in the recent past compared to what we had seen before. We're also seeing...
Obi, let me just bring in Dr. Kurtman here. Ben, it comes at a time when the science continues to grow, right? The scientific literature and the data and the evidence of climate change continues to grow, so much so that sea level rise projections for Florida have been updated so that the projections are higher and the timeline is even sooner than anticipated, right?
That's right. I mean, every time we reassess the trends and reassess our projections of the future, we have consistently underestimated how much sea level rise to expect. And all the evidence, current ice melt that we're seeing from Greenland, very dramatic, is that sea level is going to rise faster than the projections that we made just this year.
Yeah, Thomas Rupert, let's talk about that. Let's focus for a minute on the Florida Keys, where officials earlier this month announced what many coastal governments around the country have been worried about but haven't come out and said publicly, that as seas rise and flooding gets worse, not every community, not every neighborhood can be saved. And they say in some places it just doesn't make financial sense to try. How can what's happening in the Florida Keys be interpreted when we look at the vulnerabilities all around Florida?
Well, I think one thing to interpret and take out of the fact that both the Keys is leading on that and the fact that the Southeast Florida Climate Compact has led for about 10 years in discussion, it goes back to the fact that they were the ones seeing some of the worst impacts on the ground. So ironically, even though we have missed a lot of time when we could have been preparing better for sea level rise and the impacts of climate change, it's still interesting that it's taken actual specific events on the ground to really make our local governments change in most cases. And I think that's unfortunately one of the lessons that we're taking out of this. And so we're really missing on time that we could have spent planning and trying to implement long-term adaptations, and now we're not going to have as many years to do that.
Can you follow up when you say specific facts on the ground? What are you referring to?
Well, some colleagues and I were actually working with Monroe County back in, I believe it was 2015, and we were talking about sea level rise, and we were talking about their road infrastructure, and we were trying to work with to convince them to adopt some sort of approach to how are they going to deal with their roads and the maintenance liabilities that they might have to the public for those roads. And they really weren't all that engaged. And then in the fall of 2015, the high tide that fall came in much, much higher than predicted, and you had neighborhoods going underwater for weeks at a time. And that suddenly the county commission was all about talking about this work that was going on. And now we've seen the same thing here in 2019. In the lead up to the 10th annual Southeast Climate Compact Summit, you have a neighborhood right down there in Monroe County again that's been underwater for about 100 days. So they see these things, and that really pushes them forward.
Ben and Obi, how significant is this? Monroe County is relatively small population-wise when it comes to Florida. It is not a large county, doesn't have necessarily a lot of political weight in Tallahassee, for that matter, when it comes to public funding or public policy. So while the Keys hold a special place in the heart of a lot of Floridians and a lot of visitors, how really significant is the effects that Thomas is talking about on the ground, Ben, first of all, in your estimation, playing with the science community and then Obi with the policymakers? Ben, you first.
So it's a test bed. Monroe County is certainly a test bed, but in the next if we don't change our actions and start reducing emissions and developing comprehensive adaptations and strategies, in the next 10, 15 years, you're going to see a significant fraction of the East Coast of Florida and a good part of the U.S. that is experiencing, 50 to 100 days of flooding per year. When you think that you're going to have nuisance flooding outside your house once a week, every week of the year, that has significant impacts on your lifestyle. That could devalue your home. It can maybe get very hard to get a mortgage. All of those things are going to really challenge a lot of communities all along the eastern seaboard of the U.S.
Obey, how about from a political standpoint, a policy standpoint? You used to work with the South Florida Water Management District, so you know how these policies get made and how they get translated into works on the ground.
Yes, I think this is very significant, particularly the new projections are higher, as you had mentioned. I've seen the policymakers, they're already beginning to talk about different options, and to the point that in some cases the costs are so prohibitive and interdependent between different sectors, they're talking about it might not be possible even to adapt to certain high sea level rise scenarios. So I think that's a significant change that they're beginning to accept the seriousness of this situation. And at the summit, there was a session among several policymakers, leadership at the Water Management District and the Corps of Engineers. And it seems like they're taking this all seriously and they're beginning to address this long-term challenge, particularly from the funding point of view. So it's going to be very significant how to find the funding for a place like the Keys and how to adapt to it. And in my opinion, we really need to have a what I call dynamically adaptive pathway. In other words, you don't try to build up to, let's say, 2100 sea level scenario right up front, but adaptively basically build up roads and other infrastructure, but look ahead what may be coming in terms of the data that we may see in the future.
And this is a moving target, I guess, Dr. Kirtman, in some respects, because there's a wide range of predictions as to how much water rise we'll eventually see. And the big question mark is, will the world get serious about reducing carbon emissions significantly so that we can minimize the worst impacts of climate change? Let me ask you as a follow-up, Dr. Ben. There have been some guests we've hosted on this program who've said that they don't think 30-year mortgages should even be written in Florida anymore. And those types of statements have been called alarmist by some. But, you know, for most people, when they think about this and talk about this, they think, well, what's the impact going to be at my house? Am I going to flood? Is my real estate going to become worthless? And it becomes very personal for people when they start to contemplate these things. How do you see climate change affecting the big leg of the economic stool here in Florida, which is construction, growth and development, building? This, to me, would seem to have a huge economic impact over time to that sector.
This is a great question. Often when I give climate change talks, I talk to a lot of people afterwards, and I think our community has hardened itself for extreme events, for these big hurricanes and the storm surge that comes along with that. They feel like they have insurance for that. They have windstorm insurance, they have flood insurance, the federal flood insurance program. So they've hardened themselves for these catastrophic events. But what they feel like they haven't hardened themselves for is this day-to-day, I don't like the term nuisance flooding, but that's what we typically call it, these high king tides, the nuisance flooding. That's what people haven't hardened themselves for. And they're seeing their homes be, they're concerned that their homes are going to be devalued over time when, may have flooded when they bought their house 10 times a year. And then now they're approaching 52 times a year. And so they're worried that their investment is going to lose value by something that's an existential threat. It's out of their control. And so we need to make some really hard decisions about what part of the local infrastructure are we going to invest in and ensure that we do adaptation strategies, dynamic adaptation strategies, as Obi suggests, that can be responsive to the continuing rise of sea level. And then we have to make those really, really hard decisions about what infrastructure are we not going to maintain. And that takes a generation. That's a 30-year process. Mm-hmm. And that's not easy. And that's something that we're not doing right now, is really having those hard conversations about what we're going to protect and what we're not going to protect. The last thing I would say, just the last comment, is to stabilize the climate. And I think that was embedded in your question, to stabilize the climate as a world, as an entire population, we need to be at net zero carbon emissions, in the next 15 years. So when you think about that, if we're going to stabilize the climate at something less than 2 degrees, and closer to 1.5 degrees, if we have to stabilize the climate and be net zero carbon emissions in 15 years, we have to begin planning for that immediately. We can't delay for that anymore. We need to develop a strategy for all personal automobiles being electric. We need to, and it has to happen right now. And that's something we're not doing.
Ben, I want to ask a question to Thomas about infrastructure related to the first part of your answer. But when you're talking about a 15-year time frame to globally get to net zero carbon emissions, if you look back historically, is there any kind of corollary change in the global economy or technology that you could point to that has also witnessed the kind of change that the world would have to undergo in that kind of time frame?
No, I think this is unprecedented. I mean, we were extremely proactive when we dealt with CFCs and the ozone hole problem. But well-defined solutions were on the table that were straightforward to implement. And there wasn't a lot of political controversy associated with it, and a lot of economic engine that's, you know, wants to keep business as usual, in all honesty. But like I said, if we want to stabilize that climate at something less than 2 degrees, net zero emissions in, you know, 15 years or so is a prerequisite. That means, you know, 1.5 degrees or so warming. If we push that out to 20 years or 25 years, then we're looking at 2 degrees warming. And now we're talking about island states in the Caribbean that will have to abandon. And so the challenges are profound. And I'm confident that if we meet those challenges, we can succeed. What I worry about is that we're not embracing those challenges. We're not saying, okay, as a world, we have to deal with this now.
Yeah, there isn't enough of a global consensus to move aggressively. Absolutely.
Right. Thomas, let me ask you, because you've looked at this from an on-the-ground infrastructure standpoint, including roads in Florida, which is how the majority of Floridians, of course, get around, and the majority of tourists move around when they're here, fueling the Florida economy. While homeowners certainly are going to be wrestling in some cases with high waters, both on the coast and off the coast, as well as property values, in all likelihood, most Floridians are going to experience the effects of climate change on the road before they may experience it in their own neighborhoods, right?
Yes. And I think that discussing roads, I think Ben is absolutely right when he points out that to date, most people have not started thinking about this until it impacts them personally. They don't really, they might say they care, but they don't really make a change until it affects them personally. To me,
makes it so difficult to talk about it in a serious way, because until people have it right in front of their face, they're not too concerned, right?
Absolutely. And when we look at the numbers, I mean, this is what happened to Monroe County. They saw the numbers that the projected elevation of their entire road system would be, and that's when they realized, wait, we can't do what everybody's going to want us to do and what we even want to do. Everybody is always going to say, let's keep things just the way they are, so just elevate everything so nobody loses. Not going
to
happen.
And when it comes to Monroe County, Thomas, right? I mean, homes have to be built at a certain elevation today, so the homes may be able to stay relatively dry, but the access—
If we can keep the infrastructure serving them. Right. I mean, the wastewater and the water.
And that's something I want to ask all of you about in the next segment, because something that gets lost in this discussion is, how can infrastructure be hardened to deal with the impacts of climate change, particularly as salt water starts coming into freshwater areas? And that can cause corrosion. That can cause all manner of ill effects. There's so much to get into in this discussion. And if you're just tuning in, we're spending the hour today here on the Florida Roundup looking back at 2019 as a pivotal year in this state when it comes to reckoning with the future and current impacts of climate change. We're going to, later in the hour, go all around the state and hear from reporters covering climate and how cities and municipalities have been leading the way for years in the Sunshine State in figuring out what to do about this. We'll also continue the discussion with our panel of scientific experts. You need to care about climate change, because climate change is here, and Florida is perhaps the most vulnerable state in America to dealing with its impacts. So keep listening here on the Florida Roundup as we talk sea level rise, bigger storms, hotter temperatures, the environment. It's all still to come here on the Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. We're talking about Florida's wetter, hotter future and what the science tells us about it. Coming up, we're going to hear from reporters around the state about how local governments are responding now to the effects of climate change and the effects of the future of climate change throughout the Sunshine State. Dr. Jayantha Obisikera is along with us, director and research professor in the Sea Level Solutions Center at Florida International University. Dr. Ben Kirtman is a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Miami. And Thomas Rupert is the coastal planning specialist with Florida Sea Grant. Guys, I want to ask, Obi, I'll start with you. Like, what's going to change in 2020 in the year ahead, given the level of legislative discussion that we've seen here in the state of Florida, as well as the level of engagement on the ground in local communities? What are you looking for? How are you going to measure response in Florida to the continued threat of climate change?
So, Tom, what I'm looking for is coordination at all levels. You know, in the past, maybe 10 years ago, we had the county compact folks trying to coordinate within the counties. But I'm looking for coordination between the homeowners and the public, local governments and the municipalities, and the state level from Tallahassee, but also at the federal level. I think without that coordination, we will not be able to show that Florida is resilient against this unprecedented environment that we are expecting, and which will have a significant impact on the economy. So I think I'm happy to see that that's beginning to happen, and that's what I'm looking for in 2020.
And Dr. Obi, with the creation of a new chief science officer for the state of Florida and a new chief resilience officer, we heard from her at the start of the hour. How do you see those new players working with state and local and federal authorities to try to get their arms around this huge problem?
Yes, I think they're both qualified. I met them several times, and they were also at the summit. I'm really encouraged because they're beginning to understand the problem at the statewide level. More importantly, I think they have the opportunity to make sure that we use consistent science, consistent methodology, emphasizing the science, not only on climate change and sea level rise, but also on water quality. I think those two positions are extremely important to set policy and coordinate with the state level organizations like the DEP and others.
You know, the question, Melissa, every Floridian winds up asking in these conversations is, how long do I stay in Florida? Right.
That's right. You know? And that's one that I've asked myself.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I think you're exactly right.
So, you know, these three folks we've got with us are on the front lines. They know the science. They've been involved with developing the science and watching this for decades. So I'm just curious, Obi, let me start. Are you a Floridian for life here?
Well, about 40 years, so if you consider that to be life. I don't think people should decide to leave right away. And I see that happen. And that's very sad because I think we are Floridians. We should stay here. What we need to do is to have a strategy to deal with this sea level rise and other stresses and shocks we are going to experience. So I think people need to understand that strategy and then decide to have a plan. Okay, how long can I stay? At what point the external forces are too much to bear, and then make a decision to leave if necessary. I think retreat is not the right answer for everybody.
I would agree it's not the right answer for everybody, Dr. Obi. At the same time, I think most normal Americans, a large part of their personal wealth is tied up in their property. And so if people wait until everybody's starting to leave, then it's probably going to be too late to pull any value out of that property. So I think a lot of people, when they ask me that question about should I leave, I think that becomes a very personal question on what can you or can't you afford.
Ben Cartman, how about it?
Yeah, so my response is fairly similar to what Thomas said. Is on a personal level, I'm here to stay, and that's because I feel it's the best place for me to help make sure the best available science is informing our decisions in adaptation and mitigation here at ground zero with what's going to happen in rising sea levels and climate change. And I agree, it's a personal decision for others depending on what they can afford. So I sort of take that middle ground, if you will. I did want to comment on one other thing, and that is the what I want to see in 2020. I think there's a campaign afoot to have a statewide climate change assessment to include sea level rise, extreme temperatures, health issues, ecosystems, fisheries, everything that travel, everything that Floridians count on in terms of their way of life and their economy and their livelihood. And so I'm hoping that in 2020, we are going to have that statewide assessment that is going to be, it's going to ensure that the best available science continuously informs how we make decisions about our infrastructure, about our transportation needs, about our how we manage our local fisheries, how we manage our local water, all of those things that are so critical. And I think that I want to be a participant in that project, and so I'm not going anywhere.
The sirens are going off both behind you, Ben, as well as in some of your statements there.
I apologize.
Yeah, all right.
Kind of a split decision there from our scientific panel.
Well, and if this is Thomas Rupert, if I could also add on to what Ben said about what I look forward to in the coming year is I hope to see much more vibrant discussions, including broader sections of the public at the local level that also helps to inform that policy discussion. Because one of the items touched on earlier was how people only get involved when it touches them personally. They need to be involved now because it is going to touch them, but the policies that are going to touch them in the future are going to be developed beginning this year. And I would love to see local governments have those really hard discussions and create innovative, forward-looking policies that are defensible so that when we start seeing increased litigation, you've got some good defensible policies that local governments are depending upon.
Thomas Rupert, he is with the Florida Sea Grant, is the coastal planning specialist with our sister station in Gainesville, WUFT. You heard Dr. Ben Kirtman earlier via Skype. He is a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Miami. And Dr. Jayantha Obisikera is the director and research professor in the Sea Level Solutions Center at Florida International University. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your time today on the Florida Roundup.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, where we're spending the hour today looking at 2019 as a pivotal year when it comes to climate change in this state and how Florida is working to address its impacts. Now, for years, cities and municipalities around Florida have been on the front lines in addressing the impacts of climate change, more severe weather, sea level rise, and inland flooding. We're going to go around the horn now and speak to reporters across the state who've been covering this issue in depth as we welcome Jenny Stiletovich with WLRN in Miami, Brendan Rivers of WJCT in Jacksonville, and Steve Newborn of WUSF in Tampa. Great to have all of you with us. Jenny, let's start with you. Southeast Florida is really in the vanguard of figuring out what to do about climate change and sea level rise because you're seeing the worst impacts already. What have you noticed this year as you've been covering this issue? What have been the most important stories on climate in South Florida?
Right. Well, I think there's this continuing growing sense of urgency. We had a couple of bad flooding events again this year. Every year we have a bad hurricane season. While there weren't a lot and we didn't get hit, Dorian was a big reminder of just how more intense these hurricanes are becoming. And then I think also with Governor DeSantis appointing a chief resiliency officer and a chief science officer, you see movement from Tallahassee that you didn't see before. So while these plans have been in place, now it's seems like there is a bigger network of cooperation at the recent South Florida Regional Compact in Key West. You saw, you know, both sides you saw Democrats. Used to be a very divisive issue. It doesn't seem to be anymore. Mm-hmm. Everybody seems to be agreeing that action needs to be taken. So some of these things are gelling.
And Brendan Rivers in Jacksonville, the big city in Florida that has been perhaps the slowest to react to dealing with climate change. 2019, we also saw some movement in Jacksonville on this.
Yeah, we did. Jacksonville hasn't been hit as hard as Southeast Florida up to this point, but with the St. Johns River going right through downtown, we're extremely vulnerable to sea level rise and flooding. And as you say, we are kind of slow to the game compared to the other cities. We're the only major city in Florida that doesn't have a chief resilience officer, but the only major city that doesn't have a climate action plan or a sustainability action plan. But having said that, there's been a lot of action in 2019. The mayor formed a committee, the Storm Resiliency and Infrastructure Development Review Committee. We had a state-mandated committee, the Adaptation Action Area Working Group, that have looked at these issues, looked at everything from drainage improvements to you know, climate gentrification, how that's going to impact us here, and even talked about emissions reductions. And then also we had the recent news that the city council here is going to be starting a committee to look at sea level rise and ways to make the city more resilient in the future.
Steve Newborn at WUSF in Tampa. A year ago, Gulf Coast communities were all focused on red tide and the threat that that was bringing literally to the beaches of the Gulf Coast. What about more broader environmental resiliency efforts in 2019? What were the experiences?
Right. The red tide hasn't gone away. That's coming back. But we really haven't had sea level rise in the forefront of people's minds here as much as in South Florida and the Keys. But there was a report that came out 2 years ago that said both St. Petersburg and Tampa were among the 25 U.S. cities most vulnerable to coastal flooding, not only now, but in the next century. So I think there's finally an awareness here that's rising. Just last week, Tampa's mayor, Jane Castor, joined the Climate Mayor Steering Committee. That's a group of national mayors led by the mayor of L.A., Eric Garcetti. And St. Petersburg, right across the bay, has already joined that. And they have established an Office of Sustainability and Resiliency. In addition to banning plastic straws, the mayor there is also taking a lot of steps to reduce carbon emissions. And they have pledged to reduce carbon emissions by, I believe, half in the next couple of decades. So we're finally starting to see a little traction in this side of the state.
Seeing traction. Jenny, you know, the Southeast Florida Climate Compact is a consortium of different cities and municipalities and public officials. It's a lot of players working together. Do you think that could serve potentially as a model for the state to work in a more coordinated fashion in dealing with these impacts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that model has been copied not just in Florida, but in other places around the country. And Sea Rise obviously doesn't recognize boundaries, so I think that's why they realize that it's really important that some of these resiliency activities are be coordinated and that they work together to you know, like flood control, for instance. The South Florida Water Management District covers 16 counties. When it comes to climate change, you're going to have to coordinate among counties in the same way because the water, like I said, doesn't know boundaries. So yeah, I think that's it. I think it helps them secure funding. I think it helps them figure out the science in a more cohesive way. The compact just put out the projections for sea rise in South Florida, and that's something that stretches across the four counties.
Yeah. What I'm curious about is the kind of where the conversation is locally when it comes to the contributions to climate change, right? I mean, these cities and villages and counties are all dealing with the effects of climate change, and be it either, you know, tidal flooding or sea level rise or nuisance flooding. But Steve Newborn, you talked about how some local officials are talking about the contributions, about carbon emissions here. And we heard earlier in this program from Dr. Ben Kurtman from the University of Miami that the world has about 15 years to go to net zero carbon emissions in order to be able to get a handle on it. So I'm, what's the tone of that conversation that's being had locally in the Tampa area?
Well, I'm afraid in 15 years, I don't think that level is going to be met here. The thing about Florida is most of our carbon emissions come from cars. We don't have a lot of heavy industry. So it's the cars you buy from either Detroit or Munich or Tokyo that produce most of the carbon emissions here. So it's a bigger picture than we can do here. Basically, what they're talking about are things like improving bus lines, switching to natural gas for buses, improving mass transit, that sort of thing. So it's kind of nipping at the edges, I would say.
Yeah. And Brendan, that's what we're seeing in Jacksonville, too, where we still don't have recognition of what's causing climate change among most of the political leadership in Jacksonville.
Yeah, there's consensus at this point that, yeah, it's happening, sea levels are rising, but there still seems to be some debate, as you say, about what's causing it. I mean, obviously, the science is clear. It's us. It's fossil fuel emissions. And so while everybody from all different political stripes are coming together now to start talking about ways to adapt to future climate change and future sea level rise, people still aren't really on board on figuring out ways to reduce emissions. I mean, as I've been covering these committees that I spoke about earlier, I've asked city officials and like the Public Works Department, are you guys going to consider trying to reduce emissions in the city? And they said that's something that needs to come from a higher level, that needs to come from the state, that needs to come from the federal level. It's not something that we necessarily need to be tackling.
Right. And let me make a shameless plug for our digital magazine on this that you contribute to, and all of us at WJCT, adaptflorida.org.
And I will say, in Miami-Dade County, they have looked at building emissions. That's another huge contributor. New York City recently passed an ordinance where they're actually going to require buildings to be more efficient. Miami-Dade County, which has many, many buildings, wants to just have buildings sort of do a baseline assessment. They're not being as forceful. They're not requiring the buildings to then follow through after they do the assessments and replace all the, you know, leaky windows and bad AC systems and stuff. But they're at least taking that step. And I think that's probably, if they can push that a little harder, you might see other cities follow that lead.
And one of those buildings that the county's been focused on is a building that not a lot of people have a lot of experience with. It's not the courthouse.
Morgue.
It's the morgue. It's what they focused on. But yet, it uses a lot of energy, of course,
because
of the temperature that you got to have.
It does. It's a unique building and with unique needs, but it also has a big, huge energy suck.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many aspects to this, but it's fascinating to hear from reporters all across Florida who really are on the ground covering how cities are grappling with this. And there are some differences. This is a big state, Brendan. Different cities are trying different approaches.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting to hear the different approaches and how the conversation is so different in places. I mean, I was at a recent event in Nashville where I spoke to a bunch of reporters from all around the Southeast, and just hearing how different the challenges are in different regions. Like in Alabama, for example, a reporter telling me how whenever they cover climate change, they get so much pushback from their audience. I mean, maybe it's just because we're public media, but I don't get that here.
Mm-hmm. That's Brendan Rivers from WJCT in Jacksonville. He's along with Steve Newborn from WUSF in Tampa, Jenny Stiletovich from WLRN in Miami, all three environmental reporters here in Florida, as we talk about climate risk 2019 and 2020. More still to come on the Florida Roundup after this. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. As we continue talking with climate and environmental reporters stationed across Florida, they're telling us what's happening in cities and municipalities around the Sunshine State who are trying to deal with the impacts of climate change. Jenny Stiletovich is with us from WLRN, Brendan Rivers of WJCT, and Steve Newborn of WUSF. So we're going to talk Miami, Tampa, and Jacksonville, beginning with Jenny in Miami, where you're tracking a project in Biscayne Bay. What is it?
That's right. So the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers came down earlier this year and gave a preview for a fairly massive project that's supposed to armor the cities around Biscayne Bay to storm surge, which is worse because of sea rise. And they're talking about putting massive floodgates across the Miami River and a couple other canals to protect these neighborhoods that line the bay. They're also talking about seawalls and doing some mangrove restoration. And we have a clip of Joe Vitri with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, who oversees this program, explaining how difficult things are here.
You have some problems that are just epic in scale and that are not duplicated. Well, they're duplicated in very few places. Between the water from the Everglades, surge, rainfall, upwelling, add it all together, and you're really dealing with some very, very large problems.
So what he is trying to explain is that we're basically surrounded by water, so just putting up seawalls is not really going to do enough to protect Florida from all the problems from sea risers, saltwater intrusion. Even our western neighborhoods deal with a lot of flooding. And so that's one of the things that they're going to look at. And in the meantime, cities like Miami and Miami Beach and some of these other smaller cities around Miami-Dade and Broward County, and especially the Keys, are looking at their own projects. Just last week, the Keys announced that Monroe County, the cost to raise roads. I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact number, but it's going to be millions and
hundreds
millions
of dollars.
Hundreds of millions.
Yeah, it's an enormous cost here. Brendan, from your perspective, as you are listening to the meetings that you spoke about earlier in the program, what are you looking for in 2020? Are there shovels in the ground? Are there projects that are happening to reinforce some of those areas around Jacksonville that are most vulnerable?
Not any project specifically in Jacksonville. I mean, there are cities in our area that are already digging in. St. Augustine is really doing a lot on this front. But in Jacksonville, there are really two big stories that I think I'm going to be monitoring next year. One is the city council committee that I mentioned earlier. It's going to be led by Councilman Matt Carlucci. He's a Republican, but he comes from the insurance industry. He lives in San Marco, which is a very flood-prone area of Jacksonville. So he's very aware of the threat here. He told me emissions probably won't be a big part of this discussion, but I expect them to be thinking a lot about how to protect people and infrastructure in Jacksonville. And then the other thing is the city's relationship with the Northeast Florida Regional Council. It's one of several regional councils around the state. It's really led efforts to deal with resiliency and sea level rise in our region. And during budget talks a couple months ago, the city council, Councilman Al Ferraro, kind of sprung this proposal to back out of the regional council and to stop funding it. And Jacksonville is the biggest contributor to that regional council. But that happened a little too late, so they weren't able to pull out. So they're expected to revisit this again when budget talks come up next year. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. The regional council is really working hard to make its case to explain what they do, because Ferraro and the other councilmen really said they don't understand what the regional council does here. But they've been working really hard on sea level rise and resiliency, specifically from a private sector perspective. So I think if they pull out, that could be a big blow to resiliency efforts in Northeast Florida.
Yeah, and Steve, it gets to what we've been discussing here on the show, how different counties, different players have to work together regionally to try to deal with these impacts. As Jenny said, water doesn't know borders. Storms go where they're going to go, right?
Yeah, exactly. Here in the Tampa Bay area, we have a Tampa Bay Resiliency Council. It's a newly formed group, started about last year. It includes many of the cities and counties in the greater Tampa Bay area. And it's really just a first look at what the problem is going to be and what they can do about it. So mainly what we're seeing in this neck of the woods is a reaction to the problem. I went to a conference recently where they discussed this massive new project in downtown Tampa. It's called Water Street Tampa. 56-acre development in the heart of downtown is going to totally transform it. And the one thing that really perked my ears was I heard that they're raising the sidewalks, the existing sidewalks, in a place that's right next to the channel, which leads to Tampa Bay, by 3 to 4 feet. I mean, 3 to 4 feet sidewalk rise. I don't know how they're going to connect to the rest of the grid. And I went down there, and the first building they built was this central air conditioner unit, and it's a two-story building, and there's nothing on the ground floor. Everything's raised up 20 feet in the air. Well, one thing I'd like to point out is I recently took a trip to a place where you probably would think the last place in Florida would be affected by climate change. I went to a place called the Lake Wales Ridge, which is basically the central hilly spine in the middle of the state. And I went to a place called Archbold Biological Station. This is a place where they do studies on these endemic species that are found nowhere else. And the reason they're found nowhere else is because, well, 2 to 3 million years ago, this was the only part of Florida that was above water. Back when the ice caps basically had melted into nothing back then, the sea level rose, and this ridge was a bunch of little tiny hilltops where these plants and animals kind of grew separate from everybody else. And I talked to a biologist there. His name is Reed Bowman, and he had to say this.
There's going to be an inward migration of people into high ridges like the Lake Wales Ridge, and that, I think, is already occurring. That puts more pressure on all of our natural systems, and I think that's being driven in large part by climate change.
Yeah, so one interesting thing that came up during the story was, this is nothing new. The climate change has been going on for eons, man-made or not man-made. And, you know, like I said, 2 to 3 million years ago, the sea levels were up above our heads where they are now. But conversely, 20,000 years ago, the seas were, at least in the Gulf of Mexico, because it's very shallow, was out 150 miles offshore during the last ice age. So, you know, this problem isn't new. Obviously, we're exacerbating the problem now. But if you just want to see what the future may hold sometime, go far inland to the Lake Wales Ridge and check it out. We may be there again someday.
Well, get a little history lesson. Yeah, exactly.
Also, we're talking different time scales, right? You know, 20,000 versus 1800s when this recent, you know, episode of climate change started. And down here, you know, we have Everglades restoration. That's I probably should have brought that up before. That's going to be a huge part of our resiliency effort. Congress is supposed to, anyway, the environmentalists hope we'll get $200 million a year toward that. And that's supposed to help with saltwater intrusion and helps safeguard our freshwater supplies down here.
I'm wondering, as you folks are reporting on the environment, talking about with advocates and development folks, has the conversation changed noticeably, right? The politics, certainly, around climate change and the environment in Florida has changed noticeably in 2019. Governor Ron DeSantis, you know, advocating for $600 million of water quality and other kind of water type investments. We've seen Senator Tom Lee and other Republican senators leading in Tallahassee, beginning to talk about sea level rise, admitting that they have lost a decade here. So as you talk to your sources that are on the front lines, are they noticing real changes?
I think everybody is watching the money. You know, flood insurance is in the midst of being revised, and I think developers are keenly aware of the reinsurance industry and mortgages. I've been told that the 30-year mortgage might be coming to an end.
Yeah,
soon.
Will it go away? I mean, yeah, in the end, it's all like so many other stories. Follow the money, Brendan. Where the money goes, the future of this state will go when you talk about climate change.
Yeah, and I think Jacksonville's a great example of that. I think the private sector, the business community has a lot of power here. So I think once people in the private sector start really getting concerned about these issues, which is what we're seeing now, I think that starts to translate to concern among politicians and the people in power.
And what Jenny said too, Steve, is the 30-year mortgage going to become if not a thing of the past, at least a lot less common in Florida.
Yeah, I've actually heard that too, especially around the beaches here. The 15-year mortgage may take over, so your monthly payment may go up a little bit. But you could already see it on the ground here. The new homes, well, nothing is being built on the beach that's at ground level anymore. Everything is up at least 20 feet. So the new building codes mandate that all houses have to be built way above the expected sea level rise.
So our state bird is alive and well with the cranes in Miami.
The construction crane.
There's also, you know, there's increasing concern about especially in downtown Miami, some of this high land where low-income housing was built is being grabbed up by developers because it's on high ground, and there's this fear that folks will be forced out, and what is an already a big problem with affordable housing is just going to get worse.
That is a sobering thing to contemplate as we forecast ahead to the next decade, because we're coming up on a new decade as well as a new year. When we talk about how Florida is going to grapple with these impacts. But I tell you, it's been wonderful to get your insights from all over Florida, from Steve Newborn at WUSF in Tampa, Brendan Rivers with WJCT in Jacksonville, and Jenny Stiletovich of WLRN in Miami. Great discussion, and we thank you so much for being with us today on the Florida Roundup.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that is our show. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are producers.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming. WLRN's Director of Radio Operations is Peter Maritz. Engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Brady Corum. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Thanks again for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back next Friday. See you then.